This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The War on Normal People. The truth about America's disappearing jobs and why universal basic income is our future. Written and read by Andrew Yang. Please refer to the PDF that accompanies this audiobook.
To everyone who helped build Venture for America over the years, you made me believe in people. We are at the most dangerous moment in the development of humanity. The rise of artificial intelligence is likely to extend job destruction deep into the middle classes, with only the most caring, creative, or supervisory roles remaining. Stephen Hawking. Human beings are also animals. To manage 1 million animals gives me a headache. Terry Goh, founder of Foxconn. Introduction. The Great Displacement. I am speaking from inside the tech bubble to let you know that we are coming for your jobs. I recently met a pair of old friends for drinks in Manhattan. One is an executive who works at a software company in New York. They replace call center workers with artificial intelligence software. I asked her whether she believed her work would result in job losses. She responded matter-of-factly, "We are getting better and better at things that will make large numbers of workers extraneous, and we will succeed. There needs to be a dramatic reskilling of the workforce, but that's not going to be practical for a lot of people. It's impossible to avoid a lost generation of workers." Her confidence in this assessment was total. The conversation then quickly shifted to more pleasant topics. I later met with a friend who's a Boston-based venture capitalist. He told me he felt, quote, "a little uneasy" about investing in software and robotics companies that, if successful, would eliminate large numbers of jobs. But they're good opportunities, he noted, estimating that 70% of the startups he's seeing will contribute to job losses in other parts of the economy. In San Francisco, I had breakfast with an operations manager for a large tech company. He told me, "I just helped set up a factory that had 70% fewer workers than one even a few years ago would have had, and most of them are high-end technicians on laptops. I have no idea what normal people are going to do in a few years." Normal people. 70% of Americans consider themselves part of the middle class. Chances are, you do too. Right now, some of the smartest people in the country are trying to figure out how to replace you with an overseas worker, a cheaper version of you, or increasingly, a widget, software program, or robot. There's no malice in it. The market rewards business leaders for making things more efficient. Efficiency doesn't love normal people. It loves getting things done in the most cost-effective way possible. A wave of automation and job loss is no longer a dystopian vision of the future. It's well underway. The numbers have been telling a story for a while now that we have been ignoring. More and more people of prime working age have been dropping out of the workforce. There's a growing mass of the permanently displaced. Automation is accelerating to a point where it will soon threaten our social fabric and way of life. Experts and researchers project an unprecedented wave of job destruction coming with the development of artificial intelligence, robotics, software, and automation. The Obama White House published a report in December 2016 that predicted 83% of jobs, where people make less than $20 per hour, will be subject to automation or replacement. Between 2.2 and 3.1 million car, bus, and truck driving jobs in the United States will be eliminated by the advent of self-driving vehicles. Listen to that last sentence again. We are confident that between 2 and 3 million Americans who drive vehicles for a living will lose their jobs in the next 10 to 15 years. Driving a truck is the most common occupation in 29 states. Self-driving vehicles are one of the most obvious job-destroying technologies, but there are similar innovations ahead that will displace cashiers, fast food workers, customer service representatives, administrative assistants, and even well-paid white-collar jobs like wealth managers, lawyers, and insurance agents, all within the span of a few short years. Suddenly out of work, millions will struggle to find a new job, particularly those at the lower end of the skill ladder. Automation has already eliminated about 4 million manufacturing jobs in the United States since 2000. Instead of finding new jobs, a lot of those people left the workforce and didn't come back. The U.S. labor force participation rate is now at only 62.9%, a rate below that of nearly all other industrialized economies, and about the same as that of El Salvador and the Ukraine. Some of this is driven by an aging population, which presents its own set of problems, but much of it is driven by automation and a lower demand for labor. Each 1% decline in the labor participation rate equates to approximately 2.5 million Americans dropping out. The number of working-age Americans who aren't in the workforce has surged to a record 95 million. 10 years into the nation's recovery from the financial crisis, and 95 million working-age Americans not in the workforce, I've taken to calling this phenomenon the Great Displacement. The lack of mobility and growth has created a breeding ground for political hostility and social ills. High rates of unemployment and underemployment are linked to an array of social problems, including substance abuse, domestic violence, child abuse, and depression. Today, 40% of American children are born outside of married households, due in large part to the crumbling marriage rate among working-class adults, and overdoses and suicides have overtaken auto accidents as leading causes of death. More than half of American households already rely on the government for direct income in some form. In some parts of the United States, 20% of working-age adults are now on disability, with increasing numbers citing mood disorders. What Americans who cannot find jobs find instead is despair. If you care about communities and our way of life, you care about people having jobs. This is the most pressing economic and social issue of our time. Our economy is evolving in ways that will make it more and more difficult for people with lower levels of education to find jobs and support themselves. Soon, these difficulties will afflict the white-collar world. It's a boiling pot getting hotter 1 degree at a time, and we're the frog. In my role as founder of Venture for America, I spent the past 6 years working with hundreds of startups across the country in cities like Detroit, New Orleans, Cincinnati, Providence, Cleveland, Baltimore, Philadelphia, St. Louis, Birmingham, Columbus, Pittsburgh, San Antonio, Charlotte, Miami, Nashville, Atlanta, and Denver. Some of these places were bustling industrial centers in the late 19th and 20th centuries, only to find themselves faced with population loss and economic transition as the 20th century wound down. Venture for America trains young aspiring entrepreneurs to work at startups in cities like these to generate job growth. We've had many successes, but the kinds of jobs created tend to be very specific. Every business I worked with will hire the very best people it can find, particularly startups. When entrepreneurs start companies and expand, they generally aren't hiring a down-on-his-or-her-luck worker in need of a break. They are hiring the strongest contributors with the right mix of qualities to help an early-stage company succeed. Most jobs in a startup essentially require a college degree. That excludes 68% of the population right there. And some of these companies are lifting further inefficiencies out of the system, reducing jobs in other places even while hiring their own new workers. There's a scene in Ben Horowitz's book, The Hard Things About Hard Things, in which he depicts the CEO of a company meeting with his two lieutenants. The CEO says to one of them, "You're going to do everything in your power to make this deal work." Then he turns to the other and says, "Even if he does everything right, it's probably not going to work. Your job is to fix it." That's where we're at with the American economy. Unprecedented advances are accelerating in real time and wreaking havoc on lives and communities around the country, particularly on those least able to adapt and adjust. We must do all we can to reduce the worst effects of the Great Displacement. It should be the driving priority of corporations, government, and nonprofits for the foreseeable future. We should invest in education, job training and placement, apprenticeships, relocation, entrepreneurship, and tax incentives, anything to help make hiring and retraining workers appealing. And then we should acknowledge that, for millions of people, it's not going to work. In the United States, we want to believe that the market will resolve most situations. In this case, the market will not solve the problem, quite the opposite. The market is driven to reduce costs. It will look to find the cheapest way to perform tasks. The market doesn't want to provide for unemployed truck drivers or cashiers. Uber is going to get rid of its drivers as soon as it can. Its job isn't to hire lots of people. Its job is to move customers around as efficiently as possible. The market will continue to throw millions of people out of the labor force as automation and technology improve. In order for society to continue to function and thrive, when tens of millions of Americans don't have jobs, we will need to rethink the relationship between work and being able to pay for basic needs. And then we will have to determine ways to convey the psychic and social benefits of work in other ways. There is really only one entity, the federal government, that can realistically reformat society in ways that will prevent large swaths of the country from becoming jobless zones of derelict buildings and broken people. Nonprofits will be at the front lines of fighting the decline, but most of their activities will be like bandages on top of an infected wound. State governments are generally hamstrung with balanced budget requirements and limited resources. Even if they don't talk about it in public, many technologists themselves fear a backlash. My friends in Silicon Valley want to be positive, but many are buying bunkers and escape hatches just in case. One reason that solutions are daunting to even my most optimistic friends is that, while their part of the American economy is flourishing, little effort is being made to distribute the gains from automation and reverse the decline in opportunities. To do so would require an active, stable, invigorated, unified federal government willing to make large bets. This, unfortunately, is not what we have. We have an indebted state rife with infighting, dysfunction, and outdated ideas and bureaucracies from bygone eras, along with a populace that cannot agree on basic facts like vote totals or climate change. Our politicians offer half-hearted solutions that will at best nibble at the edges of the problem. The budget for research and development in the Department of Labor is only $4 million. We have a 1960s-era government that has few solutions to the problems of 2018. This must change if our way of life is to continue. We need a revitalized, dynamic government to rise to the challenge posed by the largest economic transformation in the history of mankind. This may sound like science fiction to you, but you're hearing this with a supercomputer in your pocket, or hearing it on the supercomputer itself, and Donald Trump was elected president. Doctors can fix your eyes with lasers, but your local mall just closed. We are living in unprecedented times. The future without jobs will come to resemble either the cultivated benevolence of Star Trek or the desperate scramble for resources of Mad Max. Unless there's a dramatic course correction, I fear we are heading toward the latter. As Bismarck said, if revolution there is to be, let us rather undertake it, not undergo it. Society will change either before or after the revolution. I choose before. I'm a serial entrepreneur who started out as a lawyer. Before launching Venture for America, I co-founded an internet company, worked at a healthcare software startup, and ran a national education company that was acquired in 2009. I've worked in startups and economic development for 17 years. I know how companies operate and how jobs are created and reduced. I'm also both an ardent capitalist and completely certain that our system needs to change in order to continue our way of life. Our society has already been shaped by large-scale changes in the economy due to technological advances. It turns out that Americans have been dealing with the lack of meaningful opportunities by getting married less and becoming less and less functional. The fundamental message is that we are already on the edge of dystopia, with hundreds of thousands of families and communities being pushed into oblivion. Education and retraining won't address the gaps. The goalposts are now moving, and many affected workers are well past their prime. We need to establish an updated form of capitalism. I call it human-centered capitalism, or human capitalism for short, to amend our current version of institutional capitalism that will lead us toward ever-increasing automation accompanied by social ruin. We must make the market serve humanity rather than have humanity continue to serve the market. We must simultaneously become more dynamic and more empathetic as a society. We must change and grow faster than most think possible. When the next downturn hits, hundreds of thousands of people will wake up to do their jobs only to be told that they're no longer needed. Their factory or retail store or office or mall or business or truck stop or agency will close. They will look for another job, and this time they will not find one. They will try to keep up a brave face, but the days and weeks will pass, and they will become more and more defeated. They will almost always blame themselves for their lot. They will say things like, "I wish I'd applied myself more in school," or "I should have picked another job." They'll burn through their meager savings. Their family lives and communities will suffer. Some will turn to substance abuse or watch too much TV. Their health will slip. The ailments they've been working through will seem twice as painful. Their marriages will fail. They will lose their sense of self-worth. Their physical environments will decay around them, and their loved ones will become reminders of their failure. For every displaced worker, there will be two or three others who have their shifts and hours reduced, their benefits cut, and their already precarious financial lives pushed to the brink. They will try to consider themselves lucky, even as their hopes for the future dim. Meanwhile, in Manhattan and Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C., my friends and I will be busier than ever fighting to stay current and climb within our own hyper-competitive environments. We will read articles with concern about the future and think about how to redirect our children to more fertile professions and livelihoods. We will retweet something and contribute here and there. We will occasionally reflect on the fates of others and shake our heads, determined to be among the winners in whatever the new economy brings. The logic of the meritocracy is leading us to ruin because we are collectively primed to ignore the voices of the millions getting pushed into economic distress by the grinding wheels of automation and innovation. We figure they're complaining or suffering because they're losers. We need to break free of this logic of the marketplace before it's too late. We must reshape and accelerate society to bring us all to higher ground. We must find new ways to organize ourselves independent of the values that the marketplace assigns to each and every one of us. We are more than the numbers on our paychecks, and we are going to have to prove it very quickly. Part 1. What's happening to jobs? 1. My journey. I grew up a skinny Asian kid in upstate New York who was often ignored or picked on, like one of the kids from Stranger Things, but nerdier and with fewer friends. It stuck with me. I've never forgotten what it felt like to be young, to be gnawed at by doubts and fears so deep that they inflict physical pain, a sense of nausea deep in your stomach, to feel like an alien, to be ignored or ridiculed. I didn't think it was possible to forget all that, but it turns out that most of us do. In movies, they show children going through formative experiences at home. The protagonists go back where they came from later to make it better. In real life, none of us goes back. My parents valued education deeply. My father, who immigrated from Taiwan, worked in the research labs of GE and IBM. He got his PhD in physics from Berkeley and generated 69 patents over his career. He met my mom, also from Taiwan, while in grad school. She has a master's in statistics and worked as a computer services administrator at our local university before becoming an artist. My brother became a professor, which is kind of the family business. Being the first generation born in this country gave me both a fierce love for the United States and a deep sense of what it means to struggle to fit in. I was one of the only Asians in my local public school. That didn't go unnoticed. Classmates offered frequent reminders as to my identity. "What's up, Chink?" "Hey, you wanna fight?" said with mouth moving but no sound coming out, to imitate a kung fu movie with bad dubbing. "Ching chong, ching chong. Hey, you know what Chinese use for blindfolds? Dental floss. You see that?" demonstrates a blank face. "That's the way the gook laughs. Hey, Yang, you hungry? You want a gookie?" "Hey, Yang, I see where you're looking. No interracial dating." "Hey, Yang, what's it like having such a small dick? Everyone knows Chinese guys have small dicks. Do you need tweezers to masturbate?" Most of this was in middle school. I had a few natural responses. I became quite self-conscious. I started wondering if I did indeed have a small dick. Last, I became very, very angry. Perhaps as a result, I've always taken pride in relating to the underdog or little guy or gal. As I grew up, I tried to stick up for whoever seemed excluded or marginalized. I became a Mets fan. I'd go to a party and find the person who seemed the most alone or uncomfortable and strike up a conversation. I worked out a little too much in college. I grew up and found that my zeal extended into my professional life. I love small companies and helping them grow. After 5 months as a corporate lawyer, I co-founded an internet company when I was 25 back in 2000. After it went bust, I worked at a medical record software company and then helped a friend, Zeke Vanderhook, with his GMAT prep company when he was starting out as a solo tutor in a Starbucks. He eventually asked me to take over as CEO. Between the two of us and our team, we grew the company to become number one in the country. By 2010, I was riding high. Our company, Manhattan Prep, had been acquired by the Washington Post Company's Kaplan division for millions of dollars. I was 35 years old, the head of a national education company that I loved, living in New York City among family and friends, and engaged to marry my fiancé the following year. I was on top of the world. And yet something bothered me that I couldn't let go. I'd trained hundreds of young people. As CEO of Manhattan Prep, I taught the analyst classes at Goldman Sachs, McKinsey, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and many other companies. These college graduates often seemed disenchanted with their careers. They were looking to go to business school to take a break and find the next step. Many of them hailed from other parts of the country, Michigan, Ohio, Georgia, and had come to Wall Street for better opportunities. When I talked to them after class, they seemed to be searching for some higher purpose that had eluded them. They reminded me of myself a decade earlier when I had started my career as an unhappy corporate lawyer. I thought, wow, we have a ton of smart people doing the same few things in the same few places. I imagined what the best use of their talent would be. One weekend I was back on campus at Brown and met an entrepreneur in Providence, Charlie Kroll, who had started a local company with 100 employees instead of heading to Wall Street. I arrived at a vision, an army of smart, enterprising graduates building businesses in Detroit, New Orleans, Providence, Baltimore, Cleveland, St. Louis, and other communities that could use a boost. New companies have accounted for all domestic job growth the past 20 years. More people building things in areas of need would inject vitality, create opportunities, and help regional economies become more dynamic. Cities like Detroit and New Orleans seem to me to be the ultimate underdogs. I knew building a new company was a very tall order for any recent graduate, but I had learned a lot from working with more experienced CEOs and teams. I believed this apprenticeship model was the best way to develop, since that's the way that I'd learned throughout my 20s. Win or lose, they'd get stronger. They'd also likely reflect a different set of values after having worked in a startup in an emerging city for a few years. I became fixated on the idea of training hundreds of enterprising college grads and sending them to startup companies in other U.S. cities to promote job growth and innovation in regions across the country. We would provide an accelerator and seed fund to help them start businesses after 2 years. Our goal would be to help create 100,000 new U.S. jobs by 2025. I called the organization Venture for America. People loved the idea. Many said they would have done something like Venture for America if it had existed when they had graduated from college. I took my first trip to Detroit in 2010 to see if there were businesses there that could use talent to help them grow. The city was just beginning its descent into bankruptcy. I remember the cold, empty streets feeling abandoned. I joked with a friend, "I felt like running red lights as soon as I got here. It's so empty." The city has come a long way since those low points. I met with several local entrepreneurs who said they'd jump at the chance to hire energetic recent grads who wanted to get their hands dirty. The same was true in Providence, New Orleans, and Cincinnati. Meeting with the entrepreneurs in these cities convinced me that I was on the right track. In 2011, I donated $120,000 and quit my job to start Venture for America, with the mission of revitalizing American cities and communities through entrepreneurship. That first year, our budget was about $200,000. In 2018, our budget is more than 25 times higher, and we've recruited and trained hundreds of young, up-and-coming, aspiring entrepreneurs from around the country out of thousands of applicants. Supporters include CEOs, celebrities, entrepreneurs, major companies, foundations, and even the state of Ohio. Our efforts have helped create over 2,500 jobs in 18 cities, and our alums have started dozens of companies. Out of our last class, 43% were women and 25% were Black or Latino. I wrote a well-received book, and a documentary, Generation Startup, followed six of our entrepreneurs as they started businesses in Detroit. I've seen dozens of idealistic 22-year-olds evolve into founders and CEOs of scrappy young companies that touch thousands of lives. I've seen and helped hundreds of little startups grow into mature companies with hundreds of employees. I've seen neighborhoods on the edge of desolation become filled with people and new businesses. I've worked with some of the most idealistic and noble people in the country, making great things happen in unlikely places. My work with Venture for America opened new doors, and people sought out my advice on innovation and entrepreneurship. In the accompanying PDF, you can see a picture of me explaining Venture for America to President Obama in 2012. I was riding high. My personal life progressed as well in these years. My wife and I got married, and we now have two sons who occupy many of our waking hours. Being a parent is much harder than I ever thought it would be, but brings its own sense of fulfillment. And yet, in 2016, something started bothering me, a feeling I couldn't seem to shake. As I crisscrossed the country, I often found places that seemed to be in the midst of long-term decay. I ate in diners where I was one of very few customers they'd see all day, drove past boarded-up businesses and for-sale signs, walked into derelict buildings and factories, saw the looks of resignation on people's faces. The overall feeling was one of defeat and downtroddenness. The entrepreneurship messages of take risks and it's okay to fail seemed ridiculous and misplaced in many of these contexts. It felt like the metaphorical water level in many places had risen and overtaken whole communities. I would often fly back to Manhattan or Silicon Valley after a trip and think, I can't believe I'm still in the same country. I'd sit down for dinner with my friends and feel like a character in a play about people who ate well while the world burned, struggling to understand and share what I'd seen. It was less the buildings and surroundings and more the people. They seemed despondent and depressed, like their horizons had been lowered to simply scraping by. As for me, I had gone from being an underdog to one of the guys with the answers, from finding the most marginalized or excluded person in the room to finding the richest person and making him or her feel special. The mechanics of growing a nonprofit made me into the head of an establishment, which in turn made me more responsive to resource-rich institutions and people. I spent a lot of time with people who had already won, which was not what I'd envisioned. I began to see the limitations of what was then happening in the entrepreneurship, nonprofit, and government sectors. I would be invited to high-level conferences or design sessions, only to have colleagues, even people who are considered the most successful in the field, confide to me that they didn't believe they were meaningfully addressing the problems they set out to solve, that they would need 10 or 100 or 1,000 times the resources to have a chance to do so. People were clapping us on the back, congratulating us on our accomplishments, and we were thinking to ourselves, what are you congratulating us for? The problems are just getting worse. This sense of unease plagued me, and I became consumed by two fundamental and uncomfortable questions. What the heck is happening to the United States, and why am I becoming such a tool? I began to feel that my life more closely resembles a dream life in a bubble than the experience of the average American, and that too much of our human and financial capital is flowing to just a handful of places doing things that are speeding the machine up rather than fixing what is going wrong. I was also morphing from the guy who wanted to fix the machine into an add-on to the machine. I love Venture for America. It was the culmination of my life's work, but it needed to be much, much bigger to stem the tide. I started digging into research about trends in the labor market and talking to friends to better understand the long-term shifts happening in the American economy. I wanted to know what the challenges were. Donald Trump's election in late 2016 heightened my sense of urgency. It felt like a cry for help. What I found shocked me and verified my experiences on the road. America is starting 100,000 fewer businesses per year than it was only 12 years ago, and is in the midst of shedding millions of jobs due primarily to technological advances. Our economic engine is stalling out in many places, and automation is eliminating livelihoods for hundreds of thousands of the most vulnerable Americans in regions across the country. New jobs are less numerous, are most often created in towns located far from those most hard hit, and require far different skills than the ones that are being lost. Technology is about to reach a point where it won't just be folks in the interior that are threatened, but many white-collar and educated workers as well. I remember the moment it finally sank in completely. I was reading a CNN article that detailed how automation had eliminated millions of manufacturing jobs between 2000 and 2015, four times more than globalization. I had walked through many of the cities that had previously been home to those jobs, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Detroit, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, Baltimore, and their surrounding areas. I knew what my friends were working on and what was coming down the road. As I felt the pieces fall into place, my heart sank and my mind raced. Nothing will stop us. We had decimated the economies and cultures of these regions and were set to do the same to many others. In response, American lives and families are falling apart. Rampant financial stress is the new normal. We are in the third or fourth inning of the greatest economic shift in the history of mankind, and no one seems to be talking about it or doing anything in response. I spent the past 6 years trying to address these problems by helping growth companies create jobs in different regions and training entrepreneurs. It has been my job for the past 6 years to create jobs. I'm about to lose, we're all about to lose, on an epic scale. I'm now certain that the wave, the great displacement, is already here and is having effects bigger and faster than most anyone believes. The most pernicious thing about this wave is that you can't really tell who it has hit as it grinds up people and communities. I've switched gears. My goal now is to give everyone a sense of what's coming and then prepare us to fight for the version of the future that we want. It will be a massive challenge. It's up to us. The market will not help us. Indeed, it is about to turn on us. The solutions aren't beyond us yet, but it's getting late in the day, and time is running short. I need you to see what I see. 2. How we got here. The Great Displacement didn't arrive overnight. It has been building for decades as the economy and labor market changed in response to improving technology, financialization, changing corporate norms, and globalization. In the 1970s, when my parents worked at GE and Blue Cross Blue Shield in upstate New York, their companies provided generous pensions and expected them to stay for decades. Community banks were boring businesses that lent money to local companies for a modest return. Over 20% of workers were unionized. Some economic problems existed. Growth was uneven and inflation periodically high. But income inequality was low, jobs provided benefits, and Main Street businesses were the drivers of the economy. There were only 3 television networks, and in my house, we watched them on a TV with an antenna that we fiddled with to make the picture clearer. That all seems awfully quaint today. Pensions disappeared for private sector employees years ago. Most community banks were gobbled up by one of the mega banks in the 1990s. Today, 5 banks control 50% of the commercial banking industry, which itself mushroomed to the point where finance enjoys about 25% of all corporate profits. Union membership fell by 50%. 94% of the jobs created between 2005 and 2015 were temp or contractor jobs without benefits. People working multiple gigs to make ends meet is increasingly the norm. Real wages have been flat or even declining. The chances that an American born in 1990 will earn more than their parents are down to 50%. For Americans born in 1940, the same figure was 92%. Thanks to Milton Friedman, Jack Welch, and other corporate titans, the goals of large companies began to change in the 1970s and early 1980s. The notion they espoused, that a company exists only to maximize its share price, became gospel in business schools and boardrooms around the country. Companies were pushed to adopt shareholder value as their sole measuring stick. Hostile takeovers, shareholder lawsuits, and later, activist hedge funds served as prompts to ensure that managers were committed to profitability at all costs. On the flip side, CEOs were granted stock options for the first time that wedded their individual gain to the company's share price. The ratio of CEO to worker pay rose from 20 to 1 in 1965 to 271 to 1 in 2016. Benefits were streamlined and reduced, and the relationship between company and employee weakened to become more transactional. Simultaneously, the major banks grew and evolved as Depression-era regulations separating consumer lending and investment banking were abolished. Financial deregulation started under Ronald Reagan in 1980 and culminated in the Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999 under Bill Clinton that really set the banks loose. The securities industry grew 500% as a share of GDP between 1980 and the 2000s, while ordinary bank deposits shrank from 70% to 50%. Financial products multiplied as even Main Street companies were driven to pursue financial engineering to manage their affairs. GE, my dad's old company, and once a beacon of manufacturing, became the fifth largest financial institution in the country by 2007. With improved technology and new access to global markets, American companies realized they could outsource manufacturing, information technology, and customer service to Chinese and Mexican factories and Indian programmers and call centers. U.S. companies outsourced and offshored 14 million jobs by 2013, many of which would have previously been filled by domestic workers at higher wages. This resulted in lower prices, higher efficiencies, and some new opportunities, but also increased pressures on American workers who now had to compete with a global labor pool. Automation started out on farms earlier in the century with tractors, and then migrated to factories in the 1970s. Manufacturing employment began to slip around 1978 as wage growth began to fall. Median wages used to go up in lockstep with productivity and GDP growth before diverging sharply in the 1970s, as you can see in the accompanying PDF. Since 1973, productivity has skyrocketed relative to the hourly compensation of the average wage earner. How workers are compensated and how their companies perform stopped being aligned over the same period. Even as corporate profitability has soared to record highs, workers are earning less. The share of GDP going to wages has fallen from almost 54% in 1970 to 44% in 2013, while the share going to corporate profits went from about 4% to 11%. Being a shareholder has been great for your bottom line. Being a worker, not so much. Today, inequality has surged to historic levels, with benefits flowing increasingly to the top 1% and 20% of earners due to an aggregation of capital at the top and increased winner-take-all economics. The top 1% have accrued 52% of the real income growth in America since 2009. Technology is a big part of this story, as it tends to lead to a small handful of winners. Studies have shown that everyone is less happy in an unequal society, even those at the top. The wealthy experience higher levels of depression and suspicion in unequal societies. Apparently, being high status is easier when you don't feel bad about it. Jobs don't grow like they used to. Companies can now prosper, grow, and mint record profits without hiring many people or increasing wages. Both job creation and wage growth have been weaker than the top-line economic growth would suggest since the 1970s. In each of the last several decades, the economy has created lower percentages of new jobs, as you can see in the accompanying PDF, including no new net jobs between 2000 and 2010 due to the Great Recession. The changing role of labor can be seen in the time it has taken to recover from the past several recessions. The United States has suffered several major recessions since 1980. Each recession has stripped out more jobs and taken longer to recover from than the last. When new companies do prosper and grow, they don't tend to employ as many people as they did in the past. The major companies of today employ many fewer workers than the major enterprises of yesteryear, as you can see in the accompanying PDF. The companies of the future simply don't need as many people as the companies of earlier eras, and more of their employees have specialized skills. If one looks at the numbers, they clearly show an economy that is having a harder time creating new jobs at previous levels. They also show stagnant median wages, high corporate profitability, low returns on labor, and high inequality, all of which one would expect if technology and automation were already transforming the economy in fundamental ways. As MIT professor Eric Brynjolfsson puts it, people are falling behind because technology is advancing so fast and our skills and our organizations aren't keeping up. The winner-take-all economy has set us up for what's coming. But rather than recognize the extent to which economic value is diverging more and more from human time and labor, we essentially keep pretending it's the 1970s. We've been able to get away with this pretense for a few decades by loading up on debt and cheap money and putting off future obligations. That has run its course just as technology is really set to take off and render more of our labor obsolete, particularly for normal Americans. You might be wondering at my choice of terminology in normal Americans. We'll explore that next. 3. Who is normal in America? The future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed. William Gibson. Some of my friends didn't like the title of this book when I shared it with them. The word normal has become freighted, meant to signify a certain perspective or way of life. When I say normal, I mean the average. As in, if you lined up Americans by some quality or trait or classification, education, income, savings, proximity to living in a city, and so on, the person in the middle would be normal. So having a PhD is not normal, but neither is being a junior high dropout. When I was traveling in New Orleans last year, I had a conversation with my Uber driver that stuck with me. Lori was a pleasant woman in her late 40s who looked like a typical suburban mom. When she found out that I worked in entrepreneurship, she exclaimed, "That's great, I'm an entrepreneur too." She had started a kitchen remodeling business a few years earlier. As we talked, it emerged that her business had dried up and that she was driving an Uber to make ends meet. She had 2 sons, one of whom had special needs, and she teared up talking about trying to find the right school for him. She and her family got by on a partial disability payment that she received on behalf of her husband, who had died a few years earlier. "I don't know what we'd do without that. We're barely scraping by as it is," she said, her voice cracking. By the end of the ride, she had composed herself, but seemed a little embarrassed as we said our goodbyes. I was a little embarrassed too for a different reason. I thought, man, my problems are total nonsense compared to her problems. My circles didn't include many people in her position who are stressed about paying next month's bills. But the single mom I chatted with in New Orleans driving a car to make ends meet was pretty normal. The Iraq vet working as a security guard in Detroit who talked sports with me is normal. He came home having seen a couple friends die and felt lucky to have found a secure job. The bartender in Cleveland I spoke to who's trying to save up to go to nursing school is normal. She was taking time off from school to save money. I found conversations with Americans like these enlightening. Most of my friends and peers in New York and San Francisco have little reason to visit cities in the middle of the country. And even cities like New Orleans, Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Birmingham, Baltimore, St. Louis, and Cincinnati are relative pillars of commerce, education, and prosperity compared to their surrounding areas and most of the country. Most of us live around people like ourselves. What feels normal to each of us is based on our context. Knowing what's truly normal or average in a big country like America requires some work. Take education, for instance. If you are hearing this, you are probably a college graduate or student, and most of the people you know also graduated from college. That puts you, your friends, and your family in approximately the top third of the U.S. population. If you have a graduate or professional degree, you are in the top 12% of the population by educational attainment. The average American achieves something between 1 credit of college and an associate's degree. 60.25% of Americans 25 years and older have attended some college, and 43.51% have at least an associate's degree. These numbers trend slightly upward among younger people. However, it would be entirely accurate to say that the average American is not a college graduate. Think of your 5 best friends. The odds of them all being college graduates, if you took a random sampling of Americans, would be about 1/3 of 1%, or 0.0036. The likelihood of 4 or more of them being college graduates would be only about 4%. If that described you, you're among the educated class, even without necessarily knowing it. In your context, you're perfectly normal. In the accompanying PDF, you can see the educational attainment broken down by gender and race. That's what's normal in education. How about wealth and income? The median household income was $59,309 in 2016. Each household typically consists of multiple family members, however. The median personal income in the United States was $31,099 in 2016, and the mean was $46,550. The relevant statistic for seeing how most people live and work is the median, as the mean gets dragged up by the handful of people making millions at the top. The median is the midpoint if you lined everyone up by income. Half of Americans make less than $31,099 and half make more, with 70% of individuals making $50,000 or less. In the accompanying PDF, you can see the median income sorted by education level in 2015. Again, if you're hearing this, it's unlikely that 70% of the people you know make $50,000 or less. Among the college graduate crowd, the average is $55,000 a year, with higher averages of $61,000 and $91,000 for those with a master's or a professional degree, respectively. The Bureau of Labor Statistics places the median hourly wage at $17.40, which would mean about 35 hours of paid work per week over 50 weeks. This is consistent with the average of 34.4 hours reported by the OECD. So the average American worker has less than an associate's degree and makes about $17 per hour. The last U.S. Census mapped 80.1% of American people in urban areas and 19.9% in rural areas. This is misleading, though. The census classified anything in a metro area, even the most far-flung suburb, as urban. A recent national survey from the online real estate site Trulia found that only 26% of people identified their neighborhood as urban, while 53% described it as suburban and 21% as rural. The consensus view is that about half of Americans live in the suburbs, and that this still represents the most common type of home for most Americans. Per capita income varies by state and district. In 2016, the District of Columbia had the highest per capita income at $50,567, while Mississippi had the lowest at $22,694. The 25th and 26th ranked states were Ohio and Maine, with an average income of $29,604 and $29,164, respectively. It's telling that our national capital has the highest income. You might have seen some of the stories about financial insecurity in the United States. A Bankrate survey in 2017 found that 59% of Americans don't have the savings to pay an unexpected expense of $500 and would need to put it on a credit card, ask for help, or cut back for several months to manage it. A similar Federal Reserve report in 2015 said that 75% of Americans could not pay a $400 emergency expense out of their checking or savings accounts. For average Americans with high school diplomas or some college, the median net worth hovers around $36,000, including home equity. 63.7% of Americans own their home, down from a high of 69% in 2004. However, their net worth goes down to only $9,000 to $12,000 if you don't include home equity, and only $4,000 to $7,000 if you remove the value of their car, as you can see in the accompanying PDF. Unfortunately, the racial disparities are dramatic, with Black and Latino households holding dramatically lower assets across the board, and whites and Asians literally having 8 to 12 times higher levels of assets on average, while owning homes at dramatically higher rates, 75% and 59% for whites and Asians versus 48% and 46% for Hispanics and Blacks. The accompanying PDF shows the median value of assets by household by race in 2013. The racial statistics make my head and heart hurt. There are also consistent differences between men and women. Women-led households have 12% less wealth than male-led households, and women on average make 20% less than men. This is also painful. However, women are pulling ahead of men on the education front. Much more on this later. We tend to use the stock market's performance as a shorthand indicator of national well-being. However, the median level of stock market investment is close to zero. Only 52% of Americans own any stock, through a stock mutual fund or a self-directed 401k or IRA, and the bottom 80% of Americans own only 8% of all stocks. Yes, the top 20% own 92% of stock market holdings. This means that the average American benefits minimally from a rising stock market beyond the wealth effect, which is that the rich people around them spend more money and the economy is more buoyant. So what's normal? The normal American did not graduate from college and doesn't have an associate's degree. He or she perhaps attended college for 1 year or graduated from high school. She or he has a net worth of approximately $36,000, about $6,000, excluding home and vehicle equity, and lives paycheck to paycheck. She or he has less than $500 in flexible savings and minimal assets invested in the stock market. These are median statistics, with 50% of Americans below these levels. If you're hearing this, this probably doesn't describe your life or those of your friends and family. It may be shocking to you that this is statistically totally normal. It's only somewhat less surprising to me because of my travel and work these past years. When jobs start to disappear in large numbers due to technological advances, the normal American won't have much to fall back on. 4. What we do for a living. I recently emailed a friend, David, to schedule a meeting. When David replied, he copied in another recipient, Amy Ingram, who I assumed was his assistant. Here is the email I got from Amy. Amy Ingram, January 12th. Hi, Andrew. Happy to get something on David's calendar. Does Tuesday, January 17th at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time work? Alternatively, David is available Tuesday, January 17th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, or Wednesday, January 18th at 10:30 a.m. David likes Brooklyn Roasting Company, 25 J Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11201, USA, for coffee. Amy Ingram, personal assistant to David, X.AI, an artificially intelligent assistant that schedules meetings. I responded and then got a calendar invite. Only days later did I register that, quote, Amy Ingram was a chatbot and that X.AI was a tech company. Laughing, David told me that he'd once scheduled a meeting with someone else who was using the same service. The two bots emailed each other repeatedly to hash out a time. Of course, assistants do more than schedule meetings. They draft correspondence, conduct research, remind you of deadlines, sit in on calls and meetings, and do many other tasks. But increasingly, all of these tasks are going to be the domain of cloud-based artificial intelligence. The rise of the machine that makes human work obsolete has long been thought to be science fiction. Today, this is the reality we face. Although the seriousness of the situation has not reached the mainstream yet, the average American is in deep trouble. Many Americans are in danger of losing their jobs right now due to automation. Not in 10 or 15 years, right now. In the accompanying PDF, you can see the standard sectors Americans work in. 68 million Americans out of a workforce of 140 million, or 48.5%, work in one of these five sectors: office and administrative support, sales and retail, food preparation and serving, transportation and material moving, or production. Each of these labor groups is being replaced right now. Clerical and administrative staff. This is the most common occupational group. McKinsey suggests that between 64 and 69% of data collecting and processing tasks common in administrative settings are automatable. Google, Apple, and Amazon are investing billions in artificial intelligence, AI, administrative assistants that can replace these jobs. Many of the settings for these jobs are large corporates that, during the next downturn, will replace headcount with a combination of software, bots, and AI. Consider that 2.5 million of the jobs in the clerical and administrative category are customer service representatives. They are typically high school graduates making $15.53 an hour, or $32,000 a year, in call centers. We've all had crummy experiences with voice recognition software and pounded our phone keys until we got a human on the line. But the AI experience is about to improve to a point where we're not going to be able to tell the difference. Several companies right now employ a hybrid approach, where voice recordings are combined with a human in the Philippines, tapping buttons so that a Filipino can call you, but you think you're talking to a native speaker because you're hearing a pre-recorded voice. This is called accent erasing software. Soon it will be an AI hitting the buttons, and our ability to distinguish between a call from a bot and a person will disappear. Rob LoCascio, the founder and CEO of LivePerson, which manages customer service for thousands of businesses, is one of the leading authorities on call centers as the inventor of web chat technology. LivePerson just started rolling out hybrid bots for clients like Royal Bank of Scotland. A customer can be passed between a bot and a human and back again, depending on the set of issues. Rob estimates that 40 to 50% of tasks performed in customer care are ripe for automation today based on existing technology. He foresees an automation tsunami that will leave tens of millions of workers stranded with curtailed employment prospects, a hereditary shockwave of economic hardship that could be felt for generations. He notes that most of the affected people are likely to be in lower income brackets without the luxury of time to retrain and without the savings to invest in re-education. When the CEO of a company called LivePerson says that about the prospects of human workers in his industry, that's a pretty terrible sign. I met with a technologist who works with one of the major financial institutions. He estimated that 30% of the bank's home office workers, more than 30,000 employees, were engaged in clerical tasks, transferring information from one system to another, and he believed that their roles would be automated within the next 5 years. I had a similar conversation with a friend at another bank who told me that many of the people in the San Francisco homeless shelter he volunteers at used to work in clerical roles that are no longer necessary, and that his bank was similarly downsizing back office and clerical workers in large numbers. Some argue that it will be possible to automate only a portion of each person's job. But if you have a department of 100 clerical workers and you find that 50% of their work can be automated, you fire half of them and tell the remaining workers to adjust, and then you do it again the next year. Clerical tasks are almost always cost centers, not growth drivers. Office and administrative support jobs are going to disappear by the tens of thousands into the cloud as offices become increasingly more automated and efficient. Sales and retail. We've all gone to our local CVS to be greeted by a self-serve scanner at the end. There's only one employee, the troubleshooter, where there used to be two or three cashiers. This is the case where local stores still exist. A lot of them are closing outright. About 1 in 10 American workers work in retail and sales, with 8.8 million working as retail sales workers. They have an average income of $11 per hour, or $22,900 per year. Many have not graduated from high school, yet their median age is 39. 60% of department store workers are female. The year 2017 marked the beginning of what is being called the retail apocalypse. 100,000 department store workers were laid off between October 2016 and May 2017, more than all of the people employed in the coal industry combined. Said the New York Times in April 2017, the job losses in retail could have unexpected social and political consequences as huge numbers of low-wage retail employees become economically unhinged, just as manufacturing workers did in recent decades. Wall Street analysts have deemed the entire sector borderline uninvestable. Dozens and soon hundreds of malls are closing as their anchor stores, JCPenney, Sears, soon to be bankrupt, and Macy's, close dozens of locations. Among the chains that have declared bankruptcy recently are Payless, 4,496 stores, BCBG, 175 stores, Aeropostale, 800 stores, BB, 180 stores, and The Limited, 250 stores. As of 2017, those in danger of default include Claire's, 2,867 stores, Gymboree, 1,200 stores, Nine West, 800 stores, True Religion, 900 stores, and other fixtures that may be bankrupt or defunct by the time you hear this. Credit Suisse estimated that 8,640 major retail locations will close in 2017, the highest number in history, exceeding the 2008 peak during the financial crisis. Credit Suisse also estimated that as many as 147 million square feet of retail space will close in 2017, another all-time high. For reference, the Mall of America is the biggest mall in the country, at 2.8 million square feet. The equivalent of 52 malls of America are closing in 2017, or one per week. CoStar, a commercial real estate firm, estimated in 2017 that roughly 310